I've been looking forward to continuing our conversation about Shantideva's teachings. And as always, so aware of how relevant they are, right, to this very tumultuous time, right, a time that seems to pull the mind into chronic activity, right, constant sense of being pulled in multiple directions, and maybe even with a sense of vigilance, right, that we really should be on guard, right? We should have our feelers out for anything that might be coming our way. And what I find to be so remarkable about the Bodhisattva's way is how prescient it was, and again, how relevant, right, to our here and now experience. And what Buddhist researchers, Buddhist clinicians have been finding is that when the mind is pulled in multiple directions, we start to feel distressed, right? The mind really prefers to just go on being. It doesn't like to be in multiple places at once, which is so interesting, right? Because we've really been very actively encouraged to divide the mind as much as possible, right? Have at least three devices going simultaneously, right? Be thinking about the six things that happened today and the six other things that we're getting ready for tonight. And it really seems to be highly normative, right, to let the mind get pulled in these multiple directions and to let that set into the mind and the body, right? Because, of course, our nervous system is supporting that experience. But in a way, again, that simply feels normative, right? It's the way it should be. But Shantideva and the many teachers who came before Shantideva wanted to suggest that in order to truly feel well, which doesn't necessarily mean that we aren't dealing with problems, right, or that the world has somehow morphed into a consistently, fundamentally more peaceful place. But in order for the mind to feel more consistently, right, ready for whatever is going to happen, we really do need some regular opportunities, some ritualized opportunities to gather the mind and to let it settle, right? Let it be somewhere. And it's intuitive, right? For those of you who have been caregivers of some type, right? Whether you've cared for a child or you cared for someone who's ill, anyone who's been distressed, you know that your instinct usually is just to help them really feel a little more contained, right? So that it's safe enough to rest. And so this upaya, right, of meditative stabilization is a way to just support us all in being able to access that experience of resting the mind, and then bringing it to something that is nurturing in some way, illuminating in some way, right? Because we can gather our awareness, and of course we do this multiple times throughout the day. It's just a matter of where we're bringing our awareness, right? Are we bringing it to getting to the post office before they close? Are we bringing it to revisiting an argument that has been distressing us and getting things exactly right in our recollection of what happened? Or planning something that's coming up that we want to get just so? Right? So we have a lot of experience trying to harness the mind. It's just a matter of whether or not we're bringing it to a place that offers the well-being that I think we all understandably seek and wish for. And so Shantideva wanted to affirm in our capacity first just to notice where the mind goes, right? Because there tends to be certain hooks, right? There are places where our mind wants to go, right? And then we can get hooked there. So first just to begin to identify those dynamics. So it's a little bit like trying to go on vacation, right? And we keep taking that wrong turn. Maybe the signage isn't so good. You're on the thruway, and suddenly the signage is really not great. And you're getting off, and you're ending up on the Garden State Parkway. You're heading in the wrong direction. So over time, right, just knowing, this is what tends to happen. And because I have an intention, there's some place I want to go that I trust will actually be freeing, right? Will help me understand who I am and this world that I'm a part of. I'm first going to get to know those obstacles. Right? So in the first stanza, and this is actually a more contemporary translation. Let me grab my reading glasses. Shantideva says, a distracted mind will naturally dwell between the fangs of delusions. Therefore, cultivate meditative concentration. I love the image, right? A distracted mind will naturally dwell between the fangs of delusions. Therefore, cultivate meditative concentration. And as I was sitting a little bit this morning, I had these various associations to those fangs. First, I had a vampiric association, right? Someone coming in, right, trying to get something that's not necessarily on offer. But then I realized that Shantideva probably was pointing to that primal part of our nature, right? The Wolverine part, right? And there's a reason why wolves are archetypal, right? Because they capture that primal desire, right? That really is just, it's part of the mind. And it's not inherently problematic. I really want to challenge this notion that it's inherently problematic. But it tends to be problematic because if it's not brought into relationship with mindfulness, with consciousness, then that, right, that primal part of our being that just wants what we want when we want it can get so powerful, right, that our fangs of delusion really find something to chomp into, right? And we might get fixated there. So Shantideva says, look, the primary distractions, right, that activate that primal longing frequently are other people, right? So we want certain people to love us in a very particular way, to take care of us in a very particular way, to not harm us, which to some degree this is understandable, right? I mean, we do need to be looking out for ourselves. It's just that intelligent discernment can slip into the fierce attachment, right? That we must be loved by certain people. And for the clinicians in the room or the people who are psychologically oriented, you can appreciate how this attachment can generate so much suffering. right? And just think about your family for a moment, right? Often we can just work with our family, right? There's this determination often to get one person out of, is it 7.5 billion now? Something like that. There are 7.5 billion people in the world, but mine says, no, this person must. They must take care of me. They must love me, and they should get to know me better so that they can love me more skillfully. Listen, I'm all for it. I really embark on this campaign quite a bit. But I'm also aware of how much suffering it can generate. Because if we're up against somebody's inability, their limitation, they don't have that capacity. But the mind is, right, that primal part of the mind is too activated to accept what's not possible. Then we tend to get our fangs into the delusion that maybe we can get what we insist on getting if we get things just so. It is really fascinating, right? I mean, we're very determined creatures. It is extraordinary, right? Our powers of determination. The other primary category, right, of a fierce attachment that tends to pull us away from that calm abiding is our own being. Right? I must become the person that I felt I was determined to be whenever, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, that these particular people felt I should be. And if I don't fulfill that endeavor, then I'm going to be chronically miserable. Right? And so we tend to have these two areas where we keep taking the wrong turn. And no judgment. I mean, I'm really talking about myself here. I feel a lot of identification when I read Shanti Deva. I think, oh yeah, I know this so well, right? Of the longing, I was saying this earlier today, but it feels true. The longing for fulfillment, for connection, for love, for harmony, slipping into an expectation. It's slipping into a fierce determination. And often, when we're in that transition from that human primordial longing, I wish this person, right, could get to know me in a way that allowed for loving connection. I wish that this family system could function in a way that generated more respect and patience and love. Well-being, but how that wish can very easily slip into, right, the feeling that I must get it, or I will not be well. I will not access the general feeling of relative safety, relative well-being that I long for. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Shantideva was suggesting that if we can just get to know those places of ensnarement so that we have a better chance of working with them a little more skillfully, then we're actually going to have an easier time freeing the mind so that it can settle. But if the mind is constantly stuck, right, it really is. It's like a net, right? Or if you've ever worn some shoes that you're supposed to wear in the ocean and that you get snagged on something, right? If the mind is constantly snagged on those places of attachment, it becomes extremely difficult to simply allow it to settle into what the historical Buddha suggested is our deepest nature. Place of clarity. a place of spaciousness. That good heart. Yeah, that good heart and that clear mind. So, this is the first part of cultivating that calm abiding, is identifying the obstacles, right? What tends to get in the way of our efforts at settling and resting the mind? And it's interesting, I was thinking about how we do this with the body, right? When we're getting ready to go to bed, we think about the conditions that are going to help our body decompress, right? We turn off certain lights. If we've been reading the sleep literature, we try to make sure there aren't screens in the room, right? We try to see if it can be somewhat climate controlled. We really think about, right, what are the conditions that are going to help the body get the rest that it needs. The mind similarly needs certain conditions. And it especially needs those conditions of awareness, right? What helps the mind feel a little freed up? Right? Just knowing where the mind tends to want to go. It's like that wrong turn. For some reason, I want to go that way, even though it's going to take me farther away from where I hope to get. Right? We begin to identify those patterns. And then see what it's like, right, when we access that feeling of the mind resting. And if it begins to rest, and even if you haven't practiced long, most people will find that, right, if you're reading spiritual literature, you mentioned Pema Chodron, right, or you're listening to a podcast, or you're just doing a couple minutes of mindfulness practice, even if you have a tremendous amount going on, you will probably notice, even if it's just a glimmer, a moment where the mind seems to enter into this pocket, right? So it's just this spacious pocket of awareness, right? It's almost a little bit like dance, right? Where people sink into a pocket. The mind can do something very similar, just, right? It goes down below the tumultuous layers of a fierce attachment. And then the fangs, I don't think the fangs necessarily disappear, but they get a rest, right? They get to, every part of our being needs some rest. Right? Because we can also use fangs to chew on something so that it's more digestible. So I think we need that part of our being. We just really need to bring a lot of awareness to it. Yeah.
Thinking about this because my problem is a little bit different. I have members of my family that are very needy mm-hmm. right now. They're sick, they're old, mm-hmm. and I'm feeling chewed up by their need
yeah.
for my taking care of them. And so mm-hmm. I am constantly anxious
yeah.
because I'm not able to seem to satisfy mm-hmm. them.
Thank you. This is critically important. Did everybody hear? Yeah, so what it's like to be very aware of other people's fangs, right? Other people's need, and how we can then feel chewed up. I think this is so interesting, right? Because we can, of course, chew others, right? We can insist that they come closer, that they take care of us, that they give us what we long for. But then, as you're pointing out, right, sometimes we can fall into the experience, and it's tricky. It's tricky when you have a part that really wants to offer care, right, that really wants to be loving and supportive, and you're very compassionate. So you're surrounded by people who are sick, and you want to offer that care, but then you start to notice, right, you're getting a little chewed up by the, a little devoured. This is a word I sometimes notice when I'm feeling devoured. And so then we can really bring the mindfulness, bring the awareness to that experience to discern what are we needing, because that's then the place of getting snagged or ensnared. And we can check, and this is, again, it's not always so clear, but it's usually helpful just to check what's in the caregiving. Right? Is there some anxiety or fear that if I don't offer it, it won't be offered at all? Or that somebody will be imperiled? Right? And so we can really just bring the mindfulness to see, is there fear in the caregiving? Or is there love and compassion? There may be a mixture. But which is strongest and how strong is it? Right? And especially if you sense that you're getting pulled in by somebody else's fierce attachment, then that is such a helpful awareness, right? That maybe there are other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the world who could offer support. Maybe it doesn't all have to be on you and all the time. Yeah. Does that help?
A little bit. But it's, I'm still anxious that it's, if I'm not doing it, it's not enough.
Yeah. I think those experiences are worth respecting and exploring. Right? Because some of us have definitely internalized beliefs about how we must be in the world and what's required in order to sustain the safety of others. And if there is a feeling that it's never enough, then sometimes we need to just slow down a little bit, right, to explore that and to include ourselves in those who are receiving care. Jalandri.
I think you may have just answered my question, but thinking about what Miriam was saying, and if our inclination and if it is virtuous to be self-sacrificing to care for others in the world, like is there a point at which sacrifice for compassionate care becomes an attachment of our own?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Jalandri. I think so. And it's, again, it's tricky, right? Because I'm aware many of you are very other-centric. And you're deeply compassionate. But some discernment is really needed, even with compassion, right? To check to see what's at play. You know, are there beliefs that have been internalized, that the care must be given or else the affection will be withdrawn, right? Somebody, again, will be imperiled. And it can become an attachment. I relate to this experience, and for those of you who have had multiple people who are suffering at the same time, boy, you really know what it's like to be running to and fro and perhaps with increasing anxiety, right? Because, boy, this is not sustainable, right? Where is the rest? Where's the opportunity to be replenished, right? And to be cared for as the caregiver. As my mentor says and asks, who feeds the feeder? Who feeds the feeder? And just to check to see, and without judgment, because again, there's usually some really good intention in the mix, But just to check to see, to your point, Jalandri, is there an attachment here that I will get the love that I won't get unless this care is given, or the respect, or just, again, some relative safety? Yeah.
Okay. The last few months, I have been in a very kind of shady place, dark. I don't want to say dark, but approaching darkness. And I realize that the fangs, for me, are attached to my perfectionism. My need and want and desire to do something for somebody. So it would be perfect, so I can let go.
Yeah.
Because I tend not to let go. But it's not about my needing love. I get that. But until I realized that, and that I needed to work on the perfectionism, and I just wasn't even able to meditate, which is very unusual. I was just not able to. And I was, physically and mentally, I was not well. And I realized that I caused it myself. I can't blame anybody else. It was me and my attachment to doing something so good that someone else would never have to worry about it. And then the light went on. That's not life. There are times when you have to worry about things and let other people take care of themselves. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Right? Because, again, this, we all have our personal inroad to this teaching, right? We all have something that will probably rile the mind and want to keep it in a riled state. So for you, it's the quest for perfection on behalf of another, right? And just bringing some awareness to that endeavor, it offers the opportunity, right, to slow things down so that if the tendency, if the imprinting is extremely powerful, and often it is, at least we have that opportunity, right, to sit back. We might give in to it, but even if we can sit back more than we customarily do, then there might be an opportunity for something subtle to shift, right? And even those subtle shifts can help the mind start to trust that it's possible to be freed enough to rest, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that we eradicate the way we've been functioning throughout our life, because, again, those patterns can be very, very powerful. But in the Buddha Dharma, it's suggested that even the most subtle healing change will set in motion countless healing ripple effects. And this is important because sometimes the doubt about our capacity to change overwhelms us. And if you've been thinking about how you've been functioning in your life, right, sometimes it gets a little depressing. You think, I keep repeating this dynamic despite years of therapy and multiple forms of therapy and groups and retreats and you name it. Right, this place of ensnarement again. But just to let the doubt settle enough so that we can see how we might shift things even in a very subtle way. Right, so Marianne, it might even be, I would love to help you. I can't come today. I will come tomorrow. Right, just slowing things down a little bit.
I sort of feel sometimes that I'd like her to say, I don't need you. I have other people that can take you.
Right, just, right.
That would make me feel, that would take away a lot of anxiety.
Well, see, this is perfect. This is a perfect example, right, how the mind tends to toggle back and forth between our attachment to self and attachment to other, right? Because sometimes, right, we really long for other people to help us with our own places of ensnarement. And it would be, boy, wouldn't it be a blessing, a gift, if this could happen, and it might. But until such time, Chatideva and the Buddha Shakyamuni said, it's okay, because we can just reorient toward our own capacities and really trust in our capacity to identify what generates the suffering, slow things down so that we're not just collapsing back into old habits of mind, and then see what it's like, right, to interrupt the pattern in a very subtle way. See what it feels like. See if the mind starts to feel like it can actually rest a little bit more. Jan.
You know, it's just 2 years ago, like right now, that I first found the Sangha, because Pamela brought me, because I was taking care of my homeless nephew.
Yeah.
I felt bad. He was homeless. I wanted to help him. Like you said, we do this out of compassion. I wanted to help my nephew. Well, what happened was, at first it was loving and nice, and the longer he stayed with me, the more his fangs were sucking the life out of me.
Yeah.
I ended up in some tears. I was a mess. The day I met you, Pilar, you were so kind. Tears pouring down my face. The life was sucked out of me.
Yeah.
That was at the point that I crossed the line. I am not helping him.
Yeah.
This is dragging me down. Now I'm useless to both of us. I'm enabling him. Because I wish, too, he would say, oh, I got somebody else I can stay with now.
He wasn't going to do that.
I had to make that very difficult decision.
Yeah, yeah.
And help him move along to somewhere else. A friend of mine said, Jan, your apartment is not a psychiatric hospital.
Right.
And, you know, it was really hard.
It's
but
hard.
Mm-hmm. We were both dead. So I can only do what I can do, and I have to have my boundaries. I have to know this is not working for us anymore. This is not working.
Yes.
And thank you all for being here, because it was so helpful. Mm-hmm. It is helpful, but especially like at a time like that, and you're like, you know, thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Right, I mean, those experiences are so impactful, right? When we do feel pulled in so powerfully, and then, I mean, you're paying attention, you're noticing what's happening in the experiences of depletion, and then to see what it's like to contact those internal resources to be able to tolerate setting the boundary, right? Really, and you can do this lovingly. I so wish I could, but I cannot. Doesn't mean that I'm going to withdraw my love, right? You still love your nephew.
And we love each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can do it with compassion. You can do it with love, right? And with wisdom, too. The withdrawal is not fueled by resentment alone. Resentment might be in the mix, but it's not necessarily the dominant reason. It's also the need, right, to sustain some relative wellness. Yeah. So, and I'm not sure what time it is. Will you let me know what time is it now?
It's about 20 past.
Okay, perfect. I just wanted to read you another couple of stanzas. If you read it, and I recommend reading the whole thing, you're going to find some wonderfully, I think, funny and resonant suggestions that you just find a good forest somewhere, find a cave, basically run for the hills, right? Get out of the mess of relationship. It's only going to pull you into depletion. And I have to remember that this was delivered to monastics originally, and so they were being encouraged to not suffer the loss of their interpersonal attachments, right? But it's still it's still relevant to those of us who are so-called householder Buddhists, or however you self-define, people of spirituality and faith who have relationships of the secular world and responsibilities, that we do need, we need retreat. We need the ability and the opportunity, right, to feel restored, to get replenished. Otherwise, we do end up depleted, out of spiritual gas. And so there are a couple of interesting stanzas. At the top here it says, "Since beginningless time, we've gone through so much pain for transient pleasures, yet with a thousand times less effort, we could have reached enlightenment itself. By this contemplation, may I become disillusioned with desires and find the peace and joy of solitude." Here it's getting to the mess of relationship. "Fortunate are those who roam in nature, reflecting on their aims of benefiting others, free of cares, dwelling in solitary places as long as they please, without attachment to anyone or anything. They taste a happiness," right? They taste a happiness. And even though it made me laugh and I rolled my eyes thinking, we can't just jump ship on humanity, I was really appreciating that relationship is extremely complicated and complex. Extremely complicated. Right, and the wish to offer care, right, the wish to spare others suffering can become so powerful that we really do, and I'm all for building into our life regular opportunities, right, to just nurture the mind. That's all we're going to do. Even if it's a one-day retreat, it doesn't have to be a three-year retreat, even though that could be fantastic. One day where I'm not going to do anything, not going to make soup for anybody, right? I'm not going to go to the pharmacy to pick up meds for anybody. I'm just going to nurture this mind. It's extremely important. So that when we are getting ready to go back out there, right, to offer the care, we can do so with a settled mind, a mind that has the ability to stay in some relative place of calm abiding. Otherwise, I think what tends to happen is we get pulled into a whirlwind, we get pulled into a tornado, right? And then we are completely disoriented and depleted, right? And so even though there's the suggestion to essentially let go of all of our interpersonal attachments, I think if we drill down into the teachings, there's the suggestion that we can love each other, but to really bring discernment to what's in that experience of loving. That we can be compassionate. This is the Bodhisattva's way, is one of compassion. I'll stay with you, right? I'll stay with you in your hell realm. I'm not going to desert you. Okay, but we're going to discern how that could happen, right, without getting devoured. And so this is why the power of concentration is a skillful means, right? We really need to be able to bring the mind to a place where it is nurtured, it's replenished, it orients back toward reality, right? The truth of impermanence, the truth of emptiness, right? That no situation will remain as it is now. And that's important to remember if it's a great situation and we're anxious about losing it, or it's a terrible situation and we can barely tolerate, right, it lasting another day. right? Those moments of clarity, those moments of awareness, they offer the mind a place of rest.